this is the Rufus Project. It's free. It's like three podcasts for the price of one. Even though all three would still be free, never mind. You know what? We love bringing you this podcast for free, and we can keep doing that if it's a little bit of extra help from you as well. How can you help? So glad you asked. First up, find the Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Ustream. Head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and share us on social media. The more people that find out, the more people that listen, the more follows we get, the more we can give you guys. Oh yeah. Don't want to share the entire thing? Maybe if we bring out something that you like or one of our competitions you think would appeal to others. Share us around for that reason. If you don't want to share and would like to give us something a little bit more substantial, if you head to that homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, you can hit the donate button and throw a few dollars our way. Want something material for your dollars? We've got you covered there too. We have a Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. Here you can find a fine selection of men's, women's and kids' shirts with a grand total of one design, but you can pick your colour. We've also got the recent addition of the Rufus Project beverage dispenser. That's right, a coffee mug with our unofficial and public domain logo prominently on the side. You know you want it, go get it. Finally, yep, I'm going to pimp myself out. If you have a product or service that you would like us to talk about in this very advertising section that I'm putting in at the very front of the podcast, let us know. You can get in touch with us by email at rufusreviews.gmail.com. We definitely would love to hear from you, and we look forward to any support you can give us. Thanks a lot. Now on with this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to whatever we find interesting at the time. I am your host, Trevor Holland, and this is actually a bit of a special episode. You see, I blinked and missed the 1 year anniversary of this episode. I should have realized because, like, really early in the run, Christian did that wonderful feature on Easter movies. You should totally go back and check that out. So welcome to our 1 year and 1 month episode anniversary. So, for something a bit different and for, a bit of a livelier intro to the podcast, I am now joined by my good friend, co-host and king of cult cinema in Brisbane, Christian Fletcher. Christian, how are you?
Great. Thank you, Trevor. Oh, thanks for having me back as always. And thanks for having me on and putting up with me for a year and 1 month. But I think it's a very special anniversary. I think having that extra month, you know, yeah, gives us time to reflect. So no, it's been a great experience.
Yeah, so many places have a special 1 year anniversary. How many podcasts have you heard that do a 1 year, 1 month anniversary?
Oh, exactly. And hey, then you've had the full month go past and then you can reflect on it. So no, I think it works perfectly. But I think, Trevor, I just think the fact that, you know, so much has been happening, you know, with the podcast and so much things that go into it too. I think also the year, it's just that year and 1 month has just absolutely flown, but it's been an absolute fun roller coaster because it's taken us vocally to places that we've probably, I was going to say physically, but in the case of a lot of interviews, but it's taken us to a places that I didn't think we'd ever be reaching or discussing. So not just with the redeeming features, but you know, a lot of the features and you know, and the geek news and a lot of the other sections of the podcast. So yeah, it has been a great ride.
So I just thought that for this particular intro, I'd go a little bit into why I started the Rufus Project, in case anybody out there is mildly curious. If you're not, hey, look, we've got cooler stuff coming, so just put up with this bit and then you can get onto the cool stuff, okay? So I did have a blog a little while back called Rufus Reviews, where I spend a lot of time typing, proofreading, doing reviews and doing opinion pieces. And you know what? I found that between the time to do it and getting it out there, I just kind of figured that, hey, if I just record this and release it all in one go, I can do it as a podcast. I had been listening to the Kevin Smith podcast for quite some time, and he was basically saying, hey, if you've got anything to say, do a podcast. Then I started listening to The Nerdist with, I can't believe I've forgotten the guy's name, with Chris Hardwick. Which amazed me with just the people that he got on that podcast. It's like, hey, podcasts are actually pretty major. I am going to give this a shot. But then I figured that after doing my rather poor pilot episode all by myself, it is on the list if you're game to listen to it. I would suggest you don't listen to it because it's not good. I thought that maybe having an extra voice in this podcast would also help out as well. That way it's not so focused on just what I think, and I've got somebody else who can come up with ideas and stories and features that I might not consider. So I approached Christian Fletcher, who very happily said yes. So I haven't actually asked you this, Christian. Why did you agree to join this podcast?
Oh, well, people like yourself, Trevor, and you know a lot of people around me would know I am a bit of a media tart and things like that. So another area to to have my voice heard in is a definitely an advantage for me. And I think very much with what you said with the whole Kevin Smith thing. If you've got something to say and things that you want to share, and I believe that this podcast has been a great, I knew that it would be a great stepping stone for that sort of thing too. And being able to sort of focus on, you know, like we've had our Like a Wildlife, and you know, and be able to feature stories that, you know, are relevant to people, you know, who live in Brisbane, but also people who are overseas that are listening to this podcast. It's still relevant to you too, and you know, it just seemed to me such a great thing to get involved with, having, you know, worked in different areas of, I suppose, of the media, I suppose, not saying that the podcast necessarily fits under that, but you know, I just saw this as another, I suppose, another area to get into. And Trevor, having worked with you before with other things, I knew it would be cool and fun, and there'd be chances to talk about and discuss things that I never thought I would ever in any other way. And being able to have that that platform to be able to go, hey, I'm really obsessed with this movie at the moment. I need to get it out of my system. Can we do something? And that's in many ways. I feel like I don't know. This is probably reflecting on you too, Trevor, but on my point of view, that I can listen back to the podcast and it pretty much just almost spells out what I was doing at that time of my life, whether it be, you know, into a certain thing or about to screen a certain movie for an anniversary. So in many ways, it made me talk about a lot of subjects that I never would have, I suppose, thought to sit down and record. So thank you, Trevor, and I'm sure myself and the listeners, I'm sure I can speak on behalf of the listeners to say that we are very thankful as well, so for bringing Rufus Project to us.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I can tell you what. I mean, I've had a ball doing this. Even when, you know, we've had things on, it's just been a matter of just trying to get it together in time and balance it with everything else. It sort of also gives me a good release to put this together and build it and release it. It's such a satisfying experience. And I suppose, I mean, you've mentioned already things like the redeeming features, which I've got to say, on a personal level, is probably one of my favourites. Some of the movies that we have watched, whilst being terrible the majority of the time, have also been quite eye-opening and in some cases very, very refreshing. I mean, when we watched Attack of the 50-Foot Woman and quite more recently Jaws the Revenge, to see these movies that I always considered were just like a bit of, you know, maybe I'll watch them sometime if there's nothing else happening, and having to sit down and watch those and find out that at the end of the day, they actually are quite enjoyable, and in the case of 50-Foot Woman, quite good movies. It's just like, you know, I never would have got that if I hadn't started this podcast, and that's probably one of the biggest things I can take from the past 1 year and 1 month.
Oh, look, I think it's definitely taken on a whole life of its own. I know, even though, being a huge movie buff, and obviously this is, my thing, I still never envisaged the redeeming features to take off the way it did, and us to have so much enjoyment. And I think originally, Trevor, we sort of kind of conceived it as being sort of very much just sort of us talking individually about the movies. But I think the best thing we ever did, and I think I can't remember what the first movie was where we did our very first, banter or redeeming features together. And honestly, Trevor, it was so much fun. I think we probably came in at over an hour. We had to cut so much stuff out, but we just had so much fun because it just felt like, which it was, talking with a friend about, a movie you'd never seen before. And that was refreshing for me. I originally could have come at the angle of, hey, Trevor, here's all these movies, cult movies that I've seen over the years. Let's talk about them. But no, it's great for me to be able to sit back and go, I've never seen half these movies before, and now, thanks to Trevor, I have. And even though some of them I don't thank you for, but a lot of them, as you said, did what, essentially, they might not be huge Hollywood blockbusters, but they did essentially what a film is supposed to do. They entertained us. So really, Trevor, I think we cottoned onto something with the redeeming features for sure.
Excellent. And of course, I mean, just getting to chat with so many different people as part of the local wildlife section. I know we're kind of in between guests at the moment. I've got a few on the go, but it's just that wondrous, wondrous adventure of actually trying to organize a time when
Oh,
people are available.
and I'm sure the listeners, as much as I have pitched the idea to Trevor, me being interviewed every podcast was, kind of a bit poo-pooed. So yeah, we are always looking for people to be interviewed on that. And Trevor, the offer does stand, though. Be aware
Okay,
of that.
excellent, excellent.
I won't do that to everybody. But again, but me coming from a point of view of not, especially with the geek news and the computer news, and there's been a lot of stuff in recent months, Trevor, about piracy. I know you're always talking about things like that, and this is for areas that I've never really, sort of knew much about. But by listening to the podcast, I'm, you're making it easy for me to sort of understand a lot of that stuff, and in more of a friendly sort of way. So I appreciate the geek news, Trevor. I never thought I would say that.
Oh,
So.
good. Okay. Well, look, I think that really probably should wrap up this discussion. This is probably just like another discussion that we could keep on going for absolute ages. So I guess all we can say is we've got a pile of awesome stuff coming your way. I'll save it as a surprise unless you've already read the podcast description down below. In that case, you know what's coming up. But yeah, so just sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast, and we'll be hearing from Christian again just a little bit later. Awesome. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks, Trevor.
Well, now that I know that Christian's actually a fan of this bit of the podcast, I feel a bit more of extra responsibility about the geek news. And especially since we really haven't touched on for the past two podcasts all that much, there's a little bit to catch up on, and unfortunately, most of it is pretty shocking to do with Australia, Australian law, metadata retention, piracy, website blocking, so on and so forth. Look, I'm skipping the game section this time because, frankly, there are a few items here that are going to need a little extra conversation. So I guess this is a combination news, info, analysis, opinion type section. I'll try to stop it going on too long, but there's certainly, like I said, quite a bit of stuff that's very important and does need a bit more discussion. So we'll go back, we'll look at it mainly in order, and I promise we'll finish with a couple of fun items, okay? Deal? Good. Strap in. So, first up, back late March, the Australian Metadata Retention Scheme was passed by the Australian Senate, which means it is going to be made into law. Fantastic. Not all doom and gloom so far. Australian ISPs have a period of 18 months in which to get everything ready to flip the switch once it all begins. Now, there's talk out there saying, oh, we shouldn't be too concerned about metadata retention. The problem is not so much with the retention itself. Look, a lot of data is already retained, and in some cases, this does lock down the access to that data with a bit more clarity. That's the small, very brief, tiny, tiny, if you look really closely, you can see its silver lining. The scope creep, however, is very, very concerning. So it's all about seeing who you've been in touch with over the past 2 years once it's in full swing. So say you have person A, they go, oh, this person A's been in touch with person B. We better get the metadata for these two people for the past 2 years. Oh, who have these two people been in contact in with the past 2 years? Well, I think we should investigate some of those. And again, anyone they find there who they think may be slightly suspect, I mean, once they do have the warrant for the first A and B, then it's a matter of saying, well, we need a warrant now for C, D, E, F, and G so that we can fully investigate who these people have been talking to over the past 2 years. And as you can see, once you go a couple of steps out, once they've worked out who they want to investigate over this period, there's a very, very large number of people whose personal data is going to be accessed in simply investigating two people. And again, it's been shown overseas that this metadata retention doesn't have that much of an impact on investigations. It has barely made any difference when looking at the metadata that's already held, because frankly, a lot of time people don't become suspect until they've actually done something stupid. Again, the very unfortunate Charlie Hebdo case in France, which has been used as almost a poster child for pushing through the Australian metadata retention law, that happened in a country that already has a metadata retention law. It's the worst example you could use to justify this policy, because it shows that having metadata retention didn't prevent a tragedy. But no, because terrorism, or they've also added because pedophilia and child porn, so because terrorism and we must protect the children, essentially that means that every single person in Australia, once this is in full stream, has to have all their data retained for a period of 2 years, because the Australian government considers that you, me, and everybody around us is a potential terrorist or pedophile. F*** you, government. Okay, think we better move on from that one, okay? And on to something that is equally stupid, but at least doesn't potentially criminalize a vast majority of Australians. And that is the wondrous, wondrous, wondrous world of website blocking. Again, this is up. This is being pushed through. Forces are in place to try to get this through as quickly as possible. But yes, legislation to have rights holders demand that Australian ISPs block foreign websites that are considered up to no good. Again, there's a couple of things in there. The wording itself, it kind of does say that, it must be shown that these websites facilitate copyright infringement and piracy. There is a right of reply, but frankly, how many of these websites are going to step up and defend themselves against some spurious claim from Australia? It's not going to affect their website, because most of the piracy websites out there know that website blocking is easily bypassed. So if they have people in Australia who regularly use their service, they know that people in Australia will continue to regularly use their service, whether or not the website is officially blocked in Australia. Again, another big concern though with this is that there is no limit on the number of requests that can be sent through at any one time. So potentially a copyright holder could send through a request with like 1,000 websites that they say should be blocked. And let's face it, it's not going to take too much if you've given this just massive list, that you may well allow a false positive through, thereby blocking a legitimate site. And again, there's still the problem of scope creep. Once this sort of system is in place, it doesn't take a lot to take it from, oh, we're protecting our commercial interests because these people are facilitating piracy, to we are protecting our commercial interests because this competitor we don't like and we're going to make some furious claims and get them blocked as well. And that can go even further, of course, to actual, oops, we accidentally blocked this website that's talking about political stuff we don't like, and so on. Again, it's been shown overseas that website blocking doesn't work. It hasn't caused traffic to dry up in any noticeable way from any particular country to any particular site, because again, seriously, this is just so easily bypassed. It is laughable. So a waste of time and money, which can summarize quite a lot of what we're talking about tonight. Okay, better move on to the biggie, the most recent one that is causing a lot of concern around the place, and people I know and people I work with have actually come up to me and ask what this means. So I will go through, and this is probably the main discussion that we'll be having with regards to the news this particular fortnight. And that is the fact that the IINet versus the Dallas Buyers Club court case has ended with IINet being told that they need to hand over the customer details linked to the IP addresses that the Dallas Buyers Clubs have identified. Now, there's been talk in there that it's been a complete flip over from the last time IINet went to court. That's not true. You see, the previous big court case of IINet versus Hollywood was when IINet was being directly sued by copyright holders for not acting on these notices containing thousands upon thousands of IP addresses. And IINet said, no, you've got to go through the court and go through the discovery process. They didn't want to do that, so they sued IINet. IINet won. In this particular case, this is Dallas Buyers Club going to court in order to get the discovery process done. So it doesn't quite match in, I suppose, with the way that IINet tried to portray it when they first got sued, but this is actually using what is in place in Australia. The Dallas Buyers Club have come through, they've got their evidence, they've approached the federal court. The federal court have said, okay, under the process of discovery, you can have this information. It's still not open slather, though. First up, it's not like IINet has been sued for damages. Dallas Buyers Club actually has to pay IINet's court costs, as well as any costs incurred in getting together the information that they've requested. So as you can see, it's not that IINet lost. IINet was involved because of the whole discovery process, and that they were the particular ISP that the Dallas Buyers Clubs decided to approach to get the information. Why? That's another discussion. We'll be here all night if I go into every tiny little detail. Okay, so they're going to get this information of customers, and they're only allowed to get the name and address of the particular people they want to find out about. So they won't be able to make direct phone contact with anybody, and they won't be able to make direct email contact with anybody. So that itself, when you look at how this stuff's been managed, mainly in the US, is first up a lot less than what's been going on over there. When this first started, there was a big worry that the Dallas Buyers Club would be bringing what's called speculative invoicing to Australia, where they get the information of the account holders and send through demands saying, you've been caught doing this, we can potentially sue you for this exorbitant sum of money, but we're happy to settle for this lower, but still quite exorbitant sum of money, so you don't need to go to court. And, of course, none of the people who didn't pay have been taken to court. And, of course, the people that have paid have been quite lucrative in getting more money for these people that are doing this particular practice. Now, that has actually been blocked in Australia. There are some quite firm conditions on what's been handed through as to what Dallas Buyers Club can do with the information. First up, if they're looking at the damages, they're pretty much limited to the licensing or the fee that the customer would have normally paid if they had bought the film. So, say, if they'd bought a digital copy on iTunes. Now, of course, this will be at the original premium price for this sort of content, and I'm sure there'll be a healthy administration cost added on top. But when you compare that to, say, the damages of thousands of dollars which have been claimed overseas, it's quite a vast area of difference. That's even if they go that far, because it's not going to be easy for them. Before they can send any letters out, they will actually have to have the letters viewed, examined, analysed, and approved by the judge in this court case. It's going to be... So you look at the factors involved. A, they've got to pay the costs for going to court in the first place and to have iiNet provide the information that they're after. Any demands they make will be basically quite small and quite arbitrary, and the process for getting it out there to people is also going to be long and drawn out. So anyone out there worried that they're going to get a nasty letter demanding lots of money because they apparently downloaded the Dallas Buyers Club, I think you can relax. I'm not guaranteeing it, but I'll be very, very surprised if this actually goes all the way to the bitter end. The big concern with this is the precedent it is setting. This is something that really hasn't been tested in Australia, because rights holders have not wanted to go through this initial costly discovery process. Now that the precedent is set, that means if somebody else wants to come in and go through the discovery process, it won't cost as much money and there is a lot lower risk, because a legal precedent has now been set. It may not be open a floodgate, because obviously under the Australian system, it's not like US where people get sued ridiculous sums of money for ridiculous reasons. Any judicial approach is going to be quite conservative, and as you can see, there is going to be a lot of judicial oversight of any action to make sure that Australians are still protected and not asked for a stupid amount of dollars for things like this. So yeah, if you're worried about being sued because you're somebody who downloaded the Dallas Buyers Club through BitTorrent, I think you can breathe easy for now. And definitely get off BitTorrent or get yourself a VPN on your BitTorrent machine, because if they can't see your IP address, they can't track you. Simple, okay? It is simple. Do I have to say it again? BitTorrent shows them your IP address. Fix that, and you won't have to worry about this sort of crap. Right, let's move on, shall we? Now, in a wonderful sense of timing, the three strikes policy, the industry code that's had to be put together by the internet providers, well, the final version has now been submitted for approval. It has clarified a few things. It's taken away the clause in the original draft. If you wanted to contest a warning letter, you would have had to pay $25. That's been taken away because they didn't feel that that was fair on the customers, because it's almost like a I'm innocent fee if you decide to say, no, that's not correct, I didn't download this. And so that's a bit more in favour of the consumer. What's not in favour of the consumer is there's still no clue or no indication of who is going to pay to have this industry code put into place, or even if it is going to be accepted in the long run, because it still needs to be approved by the Australian government, or they'll bring in their own arbitrary and probably a lot stricter and less customer-friendly code. Again, though, let's face it, at the end of the day, any of this sort of stuff, you, me, your partner, your neighbour, we're the ones that are going to be paying for it. Now, I think that's enough depressing news for now, don't you? Let's move on to the better stuff I promised. First up is the announcement that Star Wars is being re-released. Just put a few more re's on there for good measure. But this time in digital form. That's right, you'll be able to go to your favourite digital distribution channel, Google Play, iTunes, all the stuff that's around, and purchase nice HD digital copies of the entire Star Wars saga. No word as to whether or not you'll be able to choose between the original cuts and the later edited cuts. I know I would like to have that choice, or even if you buy it, you could pick which one you want to stream. But let's face it, they're going to be the newer remastered versions with the glaring CGI put alongside the practical effects in episodes 4, 5, and 6. But still, you know, if you're a big Star Wars fan, here is your chance to buy the saga again. And if you haven't bought it before, I know Google Play is offering a discount to buy the entire lot in one go, or pre-order. I'm not sure about the other ones, and I'm pretty sure that'll be fairly constant across the board. So yeah, that's right, Star Wars finally being released in digital format. Now, finally, friends of the Rufus Project, the wonderful guys behind Splendid Chaps, have announced that they are doing Season 2 of Night Terrace. If you remember, we spoke to Ben McKenzie last year. Go back through the archives and find that great conversation about Night Terrace Season 1, just before it actually launched. And they'll be doing Night Terrace Season 2 if they can raise the required funds in time. Now, they're off to a really, really good start. On the first day, within a few hours, they'd already raised over $4,000. By the end of the first 24 hours, they had raised a quarter of their intended funds. They do want to get $15,570, and they are over halfway. At time of recording, they're up to $9,225. Now, if you haven't heard Night Terrace, visit the Kickstarter site. The link is down below, and you can actually listen to the first episode of the first season completely free. And the various rewards lets you, there's ones that let you actually get both seasons digitally if you have not heard them previously. Now, this is a very good, very, very good, very funny comedy sci-fi audio series. It's Australian made. It has the guys from the Splendid Chaps podcast. If you've never listened to that, I highly suggest you look it up. Bit out of date now. It was for the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. Very, very entertaining, especially if you're a Doctor Who fan. It also has Jackie Woodburn, also known as Susan from Neighbours, which is a bit of a running gag through most of the material, as the main character. And don't let that put you off if you're not a Neighbours fan. She is absolutely delightful in this series. I've got my backing in. I am going to be getting my copy of Night Terror Season 2 once it's all done. And I am very much looking forward to going back to that. So, yep. Like I said, there was an extended geek news tonight. Hopefully next time we can keep it nice and brief again. And it will be more happy stuff than horrible, nasty, political, copyrighty, piracy, boo, 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 rah, rah, rah stuff. Okay? Now let's get back on with the fun stuff, okay? Enjoy.
I thought for the next feature we'd look at one of my favourite bands of all time, probably is my favourite band of all time, the B-52s. Now, probably best known as being a punk, new wave, post-punk, you know, post-modernism, thrift store chic band. I've been quite a fan of them for over a decade now, and they are more than just the Love Shack and the Rock Lobster Band. There's so many more other great songs that I don't think people really know and should know, actually, so... And they're songs that people should know. But yeah, so this is going to be real casual chat about the B-52s. Now, I was fortunate enough to be able to meet the group in 2009, which was such a great experience when they toured here, doing their Funplex tour. But, around the time I interviewed Fred Schneider, the lead male singer, and what I'll be chatting about now is kind of, I suppose, a bit of a verbal transcript of what we discussed and what that article produced that was, then printed in a lot of papers around Australia. So, now, thrift store chic and twangy guitar riffs was what heralded the B-52's entrance onto the music scene in 1978 with the song Rock Lobster. New wave music was here, and no one had heard anything like this song before. With two girls in beehive wigs and Fred Schneider carrying a multitude of toy instruments, they would perform at their friends' houses and were invited to even headline New York's CBGBs. You know the one I mean, the one that sort of bands like the Ramones and Blondie cut their teeth in the late 70s. After a drunken night at a Chinese restaurant, Fred, Cindy, Ricky, Kate, and Keith jammed in their friend's basement. Incidentally, Ricky's guitar was missing some strings, hence the band's unique sound was born. Now, 30 years on, the B-52s are still pumping out their own brand of hot pink rock and roll, and their most recent album was Funplex from 2008. Now, that was their first album since 1992, and it's really great to be able to hear that they're still at the top of their game and still can release, you know, quite contemporary pop-sounding songs that are still essentially very much them. As Fred said, it's us now. We wanted to update our sound without losing what it is that makes us different. After Rock Lobster had become a worldwide hit in the late 70s, they followed up their debut album with the successful Wild Planet, which included the hit Private Idaho. Now, they became the self-professed tacky little dance band from Athens, GA, and they kind of left their post-punk roots and changed musical direction for their next couple of albums. The often overlooked but much maligned Mesopotamia was produced by Talking Heads' David Byrne in 1982, and this was followed also by Whammy in 1983. Now, these are, to me, are quintessential 80s, very much in their sound and their instrumentation. But it very much divided a lot of the B-52s fans because they were finding that the punk and new wave and, I suppose, surf music sound that had permeated through their other records was nowhere to be seen on these two. It was the passing of the band's founding member, Ricky Wilson, in 1985 that had a devastating effect on the band. Around this time, they'd released their album Bouncing Off the Satellites, which actually featured a lot of the last work from Ricky. But as a result of his death, the promotion for Bouncing Off the Satellites was limited, and the band almost seemed to disappear. In 1988 or 1987, they finally got back in the studio and thought, we can still do this again. And possibly the greatest comeback in recent music history followed, with the release of Cosmic Thing in 1989. You'd know the album, I mean, the one that had the hits Love Shack, Rome, and the other minor hits Cosmic Thing and Deadbeat Club. It's funny because the band never really left, and even Fred said back in the day people would say, yeah, they're fun right now, but where will they be in 30 years? Hello? I couldn't resist asking Fred, do you kind of get sick of the song Love Shack? I'm dying to know. And he said, you know, it's reignited interest in the band and brought them to a new audience. So, you know, they said it's hard to be mean to a song that's done that for them. And he says that, you know, it was actually considered too weird when it came out to be played on radio and due to the song structure. But he said that, unfortunately, they don't go to too many karaoke nights and weddings, so he doesn't hear bad people doing bad impersonations of the song. So as a result, Love Shack stays fresh for the band all these years later. Since interviewing Fred and seeing the tour in 2009, they are now down to a three-piece, which is really hard to believe, and I just hope they will continue touring. However, there are talks soon of them retiring, which would be such a shame. Let's hope they hit Australia one last time for one last hurrah. Ladies and gentlemen, the B-52s, and I'd probably recommend, if you were looking for more of a sound that's not your Love Shack sort of sound, go back to the early stuff. Definitely check out Mesopotamia and Whammy from 1983. That was synth pop at its greatest.
We were
family to see Shaun the Sheep the movie a little while ago, and pretty safe to say that this is one of those family movies. I mean, it's not just for kids. There's gags galore, lots of references. Essentially, if you're a fan of Shaun the Sheep and you've seen the TV show, then you pretty much know what you're in for. If you're not familiar with Shaun the Sheep, you should be able to see the first season or two quite easily around the place. Watch it, then you will want to watch Shaun the Sheep the movie. There is no denying that if you like Shaun the Sheep, you're going to like this movie. There's plenty of slapstick action and fun. What makes it rather interesting is that this particular Aardman production has no dialogue in it at all. Lots of animal sounds, the humans talk in that strange little that is often used in these particular shows about animals where there is no dialogue, but yet the message still comes across. There's even quite an impressive musical number in there as well. Again, very, very enjoyable considering there's no dialogue. There are a few moments where particular words come into view to help advance the plot along. The plot, as it is that Shaun the Sheep and his flock of friends have managed to get the farmer... you know what? Bugger it. I'm not going to release any of the plot stuff to you. If you check out the trailer, you can pretty much figure most of it out yourself anyway. Probably, but the only thing I will say is that since they decided to turn this TV show into a movie, they do, of course, have a few times where they go for the feels. This may upset some younger viewers, particularly if they are big fans of Shaun and Co., but on the whole, it's a very entertaining movie. Great movie for the family. Plenty of laughs to be had. Enjoy.
Shaun the Sheep and his flock know every trick to having a good time. But things can get out of control very quickly.
Boy? Oh boy. Well, what an interesting treat we've got for the redeeming features this podcast. As we mentioned last time, we took a trip back to the dark days of 2012 and visited the Miley Cyrus vehicle LOL. Both Christian and I found some of this, would you say, challenging getting through this movie, Christian?
Oh, challenging is, you know, that's been kind to it, Trevor. It was one of those ones, I think, well, I did it in two parts, but I felt that even as I was watching it, I could have done it in much more, in many more segments than I did. It was an interesting film, and its existence probably, I suppose, I'd say baffles me a little bit. So I'm interested to know, Trevor, what made you choose this as our film, and was it something that you'd heard about? Like, I think I'd seen the DVD case somewhere, and that's about all I knew about it.
Yeah, really, I had heard of it, and I had heard of its reputation, and I don't want to give away the goods. There is one particular movie that I am thinking about including in the redeeming features this year, but I think I need a lot of warm-up and preparation before going to what I think is a movie that I would never have thought of watching before we started doing this segment. So I've almost picked this as training to prepare.
Well, Well, it's good because we're both out of our comfort zones, even though Redeeming Features usually does push us out of our comfort zone. I felt that this was very much, yeah, we were going in this very totally new. It wasn't culty. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't coming from any sort of angle like that. So, yes, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, probably you should just go a few basics about the movie. As we mentioned, it came out in 2012. LOL, it stars Miley Cyrus and Demi Moore. It's rated a grand total of 4.2 on IMDb, which I find surprising. And, I mean, to start with, I mean, we do start off with movies that tend to have a bit of a bad rep or are considered a little subpar. So before we get to our opinions, if you haven't already guessed, thought I'd have a dig through Amazon and find a tasty one-star review. And I have a review here by A. Simpson. The title of it is simply Awful. There was very little plot, just a bunch of Miley Cyrus running around being all dramatic and way too many attempts at an interesting plot that's just left floundering. One girl is a sex freak. Boy's dad hates his music. Miley's mum smokes pot. WTF is about the only thing that can be used to describe this. No, you should read this one. Watch this with the sound off, and at the very least, you'll have an absurd number of attractive people running around on screen. One star.
Actually, well, Trevor, it's actually refreshing to hear you read out a review where they actually are supporting our opinion.
Oh, no.
And not someone who's actually, you know, kissing the ass of Miley Cyrus or you know, or the film itself. So, yeah, I definitely think he summed up a lot of the way I was feeling about watching the film. And you know, the very much, it is just a lot of scenes upon scenes and nothing really happens. You know, there's a couple of notes I've made where, you know, there's a couple of parts where I think, you know, maybe this is what they're trying to get at. But I think even giving the filmmakers that much credit that a lot of this stuff had deep and meaningful merit is probably asking a bit much. But like, I know what you mentioned there, you know, way back in 2012 when this came out, this is quite interesting because it was pretty much pre-Wrecking Ball in 2013, before all that, the shenanigans with the tongue being poked out and everything like that. And it was sort of between that Hannah Montana period and this recent sort of, shenanigans, because, you know, she was trying to break out of her Disney roots and I believe this movie was supposed to be the vehicle that did that. But really, it's like they threw in any sort of chance for her to have sexual encounters and all these different things to really, really ham, you know, hit home the fact that, yeah, this is not a Disney movie. I don't know if that became obvious to you, Trev. They were just trying too hard with it.
Yeah, they certainly were trying very, very hard to be edgy and almost indie with a lot of the stuff they did. Tell you the truth, when she first turned up, given the more recent, press with regards to Miley Cyrus, I actually had a bit of trouble recognising her with her clothes on. But, you know, eventually I went, okay, oh, yeah, that's Miley. Fair enough. There we go.
hard to recognize her without a tongue out of her mouth.
That's right. And she wasn't twerking against people or anything like that. So.
And believe it or not, not that I'm really a fan or anything, but it was actually refreshing, to be honest, to see sort of the pre-tainted Miley, even though I think by this stage she was still well and truly a bit messed up. And I don't know if it was just me, Trevor, but I remember noting, was that Miley Cyrus singing the opening song? I tried it throughout the whole film to see if she was. There was a couple of times they'd use almost, you know, sound-alike singers on the soundtrack, and I remember thinking, is that her singing the opening song? But I don't think it was, so I don't know if she contributed in any way to the soundtrack. She's already done enough.
I tell the truth, I didn't look at that, but... I mean, speaking of the soundtrack, gee, can we go for as much indie cred as we can shove into a movie as possible? This hits so many high school movie cliches. It's a high school movie, by the way, and including having a battle of the bands apparently going on in the background when they remember that that's a plot line they put in at some point.
Just added at the very end there.
Yeah, and it's just that style of movie. If you think of like the high art indie movie with the what sort of genre, like the ballady style songs and you know, the slightly quirky indie styles of those. It's just absolutely chock-a-block. There's even, like, montages of her becoming attracted to this boy just set to this ongoing song. And you're thinking, can you try any harder to try to insert cred into this movie?
Well, it was funny because, I can't think of the song now, but after listening to, after watching, finishing the movie this afternoon, I still had that damn song going around in my head. Thankfully, I've forgotten it now. And it was to the point where, yeah, as you said, they were using it so much to the point, not just using it, and I've seen this in a lot of movies, and I think it's quite amusing. They'll use them in, you know, in the concert sort of scenes, the battle of the band scenes, but then insert that same song later on to give it sort of emotional feeling, and it really just comes across sort of like what do we have back in what was it, Two of a Kind with Olivia Newton-John, where that Twist of Fate was played like 10 million times. This was probably played 3, you know, like 13 million times more than that. So yeah, no, it definitely, thank God I got it out of my head, but yeah, no, it did come across very, yeah, that they're trying too hard for this whole teen movie thing and really throwing in every cliche they can, and it really came across quite, you know, bad.
I think also because I mean, it's not an original movie, it is based on a French movie that was released a few years beforehand called Laughing Out Loud (LOL) in case you didn't know. And I think one thing that helps it be so unbalanced and just so all over the place is I think they left some of the stuff from the French movie in, even though it really didn't suit an American movie. There's this bizarre scene, really, really weird scene, where Miley comes home and just basically disrobes in the bathroom, right in front of her mother and younger sister, who are in the bath together, and then Mum's just going, "Did you get a Brazilian?" It was just such a... I had to mention that because I was watching it going, what the hell is going on with this scene?
We weren't even 5 minutes into the movie, too, from memory. And I think the funny thing is that I think the following scene has them all then sleeping together.
That's right. That's right.
So I don't know. You know how I mentioned earlier, I don't know if they were trying to be deep with some things. I don't know. That might have been them trying to be, you know, present the family as being open-minded. But no, I don't think that was what it was. It was quite bizarre. And it is like what you were saying. You wonder if that was remnant of the French film that just got lost in translation, like a few of the scenes, actually. So... And it does make you wonder too, you know, for our listeners out there, whilst it is a teen movie, it also does sort of, it sort of looks at Demi Moore's character as Miley Cyrus's mum and sort of her I suppose, love life and, you know, her relationships with her ex-husband and things like that. So, you know, I wonder if the elements of the very adult stuff was very much lingering over even from the French film as well. I'm not sure, but I don't know. I think possibly the filmmakers were getting at, and I don't know, Trevor, if I am giving them more credit than what they are due, but I don't know if the whole point of having the mother and the daughter was to show that Demi Moore is pretty much an older version of Miley Cyrus, or Miley Cyrus has become, you know, she's behaved just the way that her mum used to, because it seems like the mum, the grandma, they all seem to be the kind of these, I don't know, cougars in some way.
There was even a scene where Demi Moore turns to her mother in the movie, the grandmother, and just goes, "I was never like this, was I?" And she just pats her in the back and said, "Yeah, well, sometimes you weren't." Yeah.
So I just get the feeling that, and I felt that even though the film doesn't really tie itself up, and honestly, I can never give any spoilers because there really isn't any, but you just sort of... got to the feeling at the end is that the characters were supposed to realise, oh, we are all the same type of person and happily love, you know, be all lovey-dovey again. But, you know, and that was, you know, I'm probably jumping forward a bit, but I even noticed that Trevor, they just sort of just tied the movie up like suddenly through that battle of the band thing, and it was just kind of over. And you're sort of sitting there going, is, you know, an hour and a half later, is anything going to happen?
I think the Battle of the Bands also would have been more convincing if they actually showed more than one band.
And the fact, too, I think the band that won was called No Shampoo. I remember noting down. I thought that
something
was quite
like
interesting.
That. Yeah, the band with Miley's ex-boyfriend and his best friend, her current boyfriend.
Yeah, no shampoo. And even though they do look like that, you know, they do look like they use shampoo, but you do think, God, what were the other names of the bands in that competition? We will never know.
No, because they don't get mentioned or acknowledged in any way whatsoever. So it's nice to know that the band in the movie wins because they're the only band in the competition.
I think School of Rock did a much better job with that scene. But looking back with the title of the film too, like I was sort of thinking, you know, like you've got, you know, it uses LOL in the posters, it's, you know, LOL sort of in a computer tech sort of thing. So I don't know if the whole point of the whole LOL thing was the fact that she's always texting, even though it wasn't a huge thing. I know the poster's got her texting on, so I'm wondering if that was a lot of the angle. But then you also, of course, for those people that missed that, and we've got to make something a little bit more obvious, her name is actually Lola, LOL for short. So, of course, when they brought that in, I went, oh, of course you had to say that, didn't you? Couldn't you have just left it alone?
No, they
could. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it would be very convenient, though, the way that texting and messaging works in this movie. So you're not just looking at this small screen. Everything appears in, like, this translucent square in the air beside you until you dramatically close your laptop at the end of the messaging session. There's so many closing of laptops, either in happy bliss or closing in anger. Just all these conversations with floating text, and at the end, plunk, close the laptop.
It does also make it, even though I don't know if the concept would get annoying, you do think to yourself, maybe they should have used that style a lot more, because they didn't do it too often, but I think that could have been something a bit quirky if they'd, you know, used that throughout the movie a lot more, but it was just another thing that just sort of never really went anywhere. And you know, not that I'm shock horror spoilers, but in the last scene, she does turn around and say that LOL actually means, love out loud, or lots of love.
Lots of lovey laugh out loud of love of.
Yeah, so that's the big twist. Oh, sorry, I should have told everyone there were spoilers in that bit. But yeah, she does actually say it means lots of love at the end, which to me just sort of made me go, ugh. Can you make it even more sickening? An interesting section, Trevor, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this. And it did come up a lot, you know, when I first read about the film plot-wise, you kept hearing mentions of them going to Paris. Now,
yes.
I thought this was going to be a big centrepiece for the film, but really, I don't know if I blinked and missed it, Trevor, but they kind of just went and came home again. But yeah, I'd be interested to talk about the Paris scene. And I'm wondering, too, if some of those scenes were carried over from the French film, because there was some interesting scenes with some of the people they encounter in France in that very brief section.
Yes, indeed. I actually do have a few notes about that Paris trip. First up is just like, how many French cliches can we hit in a very, very short space of time? They get fed snails, the daughter of one of the French families that a couple of the boys are staying with just immediately tries to hit on this black dude. Miley herself stays with a family that is obsessed with Joan of Arc to the point that the daughter is called Joan and is actually made up with a haircut and everything like Joan of Arc. what else can we say about it? When they finally do get to Paris, it looked like they were trying to basically just recreate the opening from Friends in Paris, playing around in the fountain and running around having a good time. The only decent thing was the version of It's All Right by Supergrass entirely in French. I quite enjoyed that song.
Yeah. I actually liked that. That was something that kind of woke me out of my slumber when that part finally came on.
Yeah, that really was about the only thing that caught my interest in this entire damn movie.
It almost gave you the feel. I can't remember offhand if you saw any landmarks from, you know, it was definitely filmed in Paris, because I do believe you saw landmarks. But anyway,
yeah,
I get the feeling
there was a considerable bit of that Paris montage section in front of the Eiffel Tower.
But I get the feeling that has been, they probably might have only had a shooting day for one afternoon, so they've gone, okay, let's shoot as much as we can and we'll just make the Paris bit a montage.
Yes.
And film the rest back in America. But it just became quite bizarre. But there's also, you know, how you mentioned about the daughter that was kind of cracking onto the the guys living in the house, that kind of, a lot of that sort of dynamic between the families and the sort of stuff seemed like that was very much, could have been left over from the French film. I don't know, I kind of caught that. And then, like, I remember even seeing in the credits Gina Gershon and went, oh, wow, where's she? And she comes up, like, 20 minutes before the end, almost in a blink and you miss it role. That was strange.
She was so underused. She can actually act, which made her stand out to me in this movie. But, yeah, it's just kind of like a couple of scenes around a kitchen table with Demi Moore and either her ex-husband or the cop she's hooking, in the process of hooking up with throughout this movie. Because apparently she was completely disabled when she broke her heel, so the cop had to give her a lift home. And then there's this other couple with Gina Gershon and this other dude who is completely forgettable. Essentially is Gina Gershon's straight man in these scenes. And you're thinking, that's Gina Gershon! Why is she not got a bigger role in this movie? Because, frankly, she's good.
I know. You know, hey, she single-handedly saved Showgirl. She deserves more credit.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I thought it was quite strange that they added her in there. But it's the other thing, I think maybe she was something to do with the original French film, and it was kind of one of those, you know, those kind of nods to the original. I don't know. But, yeah, no, I did think she was very underutilized, but she was probably also like, help, get me out of here. Give me the smallest role possible.
Yeah. Well, you could tell that she was enjoying the role. But, again, it was such a small part of the movie and really just did not have any impact on anything else. So it may as well not have been there.
Well, I personally think the whole Paris trip should have technically not even been there. It's funny because Miley's character, comes up with this line at the end after she gets back and her mum, Demi, says, what was your trip like? And I think literally, Miley, I think you summed up what the audience was thinking as well. It was nothing special. Like, who gets back? She's begged and pleaded with her mum. She's done all these bad things and she finally begs and pleads with her mum to let her go to Paris. And it's funny, that scene was hilarious, how quickly she managed to say yes. Anyway, she does all that and comes back and pretty much says to her mum, yeah, it was nothing special, and goes back her business. Oh, I don't know if she was just spoilt or maybe she's like, hey, we only shot there for half a day. I didn't get to see much.
Yeah, nothing special. We flew in, flew out.
Exactly. Stood in front of the Eiffel Tower and did a montage. But yeah, so that kind of, that whole section kind of, I was waiting for that to be the, you know, like the prom scene in Carrie, to be the big penultimate thing going to Paris, but it didn't become that.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, in France, that's where Miley finally gets to fully hook up with the boy she's been drooling over for the entire movie up to that point.
Of course, yeah.
Which was also just nothing at all thrilling or in any way interesting about that either. They do a lame setup to sneak her in with the boyfriend where they're staying, and that's about it. It's good. There's nothing more you can say about it. That's it. It's like, so much in this movie starts and goes nowhere. I don't know what else I can say.
Yeah, look, it's interesting because I'm actually tempted really to seek out the 2008 French film, because I feel like that might throw a lot more of a light on it. Like, maybe that was a bad film as well. But yeah, it just felt like it didn't really go anywhere. And I don't know whether they were looking for it to be a way to reignite Demi Moore's career as well, because it certainly didn't work, you know. And I don't know, but I do think they were trying to push the whole thing that she was, you know, just a younger version of herself, you know. Miley was a younger version of Demi, and I don't, you know, aside from that, hey, you can say that in 5 minutes, you don't need a whole hour and a half. But yeah, a lot of these teen cliches mixed in with a semi-plot, I suppose.
Yeah, so I guess the plot is Miley gets back to school, finds out current boyfriend has cheated, cue sad music.
Cue band song, you mean?
Cue band song, back and forth, hooks up with ex-boyfriend's best friend because that's always a good idea. Cue happy falling in love music. He doesn't immediately reply to a text that she sends him. Cue sad music.
And cue abrupt slamming of the laptop or hanging up of the phone.
Yep. Cue her going, text me back, text me back. I mean, I think that was the most dramatic thing I saw her do in the entire movie. Text me back!
Oh, God. But just you saying then, you know, pretty much what the plot was, you know, in and out of bed with people and trying to, you know, messaging people back and forth, it really did sound like she was doing everything she could to try and break that Disney image that she had. And it just came across too try-hard or really just didn't end up going anywhere.
Yeah, really, this movie... it's just it tried really, 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 really hard to be an arty indie movie, and I've seen some pretty dodgy arty indie movies that still for some reason work. This certainly didn't.
Oh, definitely not. You know, and even trying to, you know, bring in that kind of alternative sort of sounding soundtrack and things like that. But yeah, but then just had that obvious Hollywood gloss over that you could just never really get around, even though Hollywood should be very ashamed.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of Hollywood and speaking of losing some indie cred, I could not help notice that every chance there was for something to be angled in a particular way, or they got emailed, they showed the actual computer with an email screen, and they have the ads beside it. Every opportunity to show a label or do any sort of product placement was just seized and used to its fullest. Seriously, the product placement in this movie, I've tried to remember some of the brands, but there's just so many of them, it just blurs together.
Oh, yuck.
It was so blatant and so obvious. Look, I'm not above product placement. I don't mind it, but... seriously, a little bit of subtlety, guys. It does help.
It's like the producers thought, oh, God, if Miley doesn't sell tickets, at least our sponsors will give us some money. So we'll put them in there. But, yeah, no, I did notice that too. And, of course, when you are looking, you know, as you mentioned with the ads on the computers, when you are looking at people texting on their, you know, on their laptops a lot too, you've got more than a few opportunities to see these ads too. So,
yeah, there you go. You get pop-up computer ads in a movie.
Yeah, so even more enticement to want to see it. And there's no skip ad button, sorry.
No. Well, look, before we get to the redeeming features, I think there was just one other thing I found quite, just again, something which just leaves hanging. So aside from Miley and Demi and their side of things, with the boyfriend... there's this ongoing thing where he doesn't get good grades and his dad starts threatening to send him to military school, so which made me think, hang on, are we watching this Miley Cyrus movie or watching Bill and Ted? And there's a whole thing about, you know, you're not going to play your music anymore. And it's quite a thing. He gets his phone taken off him and it gets all the way through to the final battle of the band, and Dad storms in and sees his son on stage, and it cuts back to him. And I'm assuming it was meant to be like him going, oh my goodness, he's really good, what have I been thinking? But the guy's face couldn't act that way, so it just looked like Dad was sitting in there glaring at his son up on stage. And nothing. That's just it. There's a shot of the dad watching his son, and... there's no way of knowing what the dad's thinking because the guy is just a bad actor. And it's like, yeah, what happened there? What happened there? Is he being shipped off to military school now? What's going on?
That's in the sequel, and God, I hope there's not a second one. But it's at least in going back to School of Rock again, but at least in that they had the parents coming around and going, wow, our kids are doing a great thing and being supportive, but yeah, you got nothing from him whatsoever.
Indeed. And but I would have thought that, you know, being such a serious dad and so concerned for his son's well-being, there was also, again, just out of nowhere in the middle of this thing, was a talk by this police officer that Demi Moore was interested in about drugs and marijuana at the school. But it's in the middle of the day and all the parents are in there as well. It's like, hang on, shouldn't these people be working? Why is every parent for every child at this school talk about drugs. Do yeah. they realise that the adults are taking drugs too? Are they trying to stop them as well?
Well, when the scene first started, he was me thinking it was, it's all the parents getting together and talking about the Paris trip, but I must have got the wrong end of the stick there. how they got that many students. And then I was thinking to myself, is this some sort of uni class? And I see Demi Moore there, and I'm like, yes, it's that. But yeah, I know what you mean, strange. The parents were just readily available.
Yes. Safe to say there are inconsistencies galore. I'm not really too optimistic about this next question, Christian, but obviously this was my suggestion, so I'm going to let you go first, of course. And tell me, did you find any redeeming features?
Well, to be honest, Trevor, I've got here written on my notes, as I usually have on a section saying, what the redeemable features are. And I've actually put an IR instead of redeemable because I believe it actually is irredeemable. I cannot find, you've got your glimpses of Gina Gershon. I'm thinking of, I'm really just clutching at straws here, Trev, thinking of anything I can say to give it give it some sort of cred. But I really just think its existence is quite unnecessary. I believe it was supposed to be a vehicle for Miley to break out of her Disney mold, but really I don't think as many people saw it or wanted to see it as was intended. And I just think that it's, as a result with a lot of these vehicle films, there's not much substance. And I just don't think, whilst she's, charming enough, I don't think her and this plot in particular is enough to hold an entire movie. And even Demi Moore coming along and, you've got other people like Thomas Jane and as I said, Gina Gershon and a couple of other people in it. Even they couldn't save something that was obviously so floundering in the plot department and the script department not in the plot department. They had lots of great subplots and plots there that could have easily been picked up and taken to different places, but it just failed miserably, and they just threw in as much as they could to make it Indian cool and as adult for Miley as they could. So, Trevor, I actually do find it irredeemable.
Wow, not a single thing. it supergrasses, it's all right in French.
Oh, definitely.
That was awesome. It took 70 damn minutes to get to the song. 70 minutes of tripe, of nothing, of bad plots going nowhere. You said Miley was all right. I could not stand that character Miley Cyrus was playing. She was just so wishy-washy. Nobody would ever defend themselves either in this. Like, someone accuses somebody of something else. They just go, then I go, hang on, no, that wasn't me. They go, oh my God, yeah, and stop off at a huff like they're guilty. It's just like a big bunch of cliched ideas just thrown together and thrown against a wall with a whatever basic plot they pulled out of the original French version. One decent tune amongst a pile of angsty soft pop, and I had no care at all about what happened to any of these characters. At the end, the police person is going off and taking Demi Moore on a date in a police boat. I mean, is he meant to use police stuff like that? And they could have sunk, and we would have gone, oh, they sunk. Oh, that's fine. So, yeah, this movie is just... So, it's completely irredeemable.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Trevor, I think you've summed it up in a nutshell. You're as mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore.
Oh, I want my, however long it was, way too long. I remember thinking, it just kept on going and going and going. I remember thinking, why isn't this movie finished yet? Nothing's happening. Just end it. Just end it and let me finish.
Yeah, give me back some life while I've still got it. I think we're pretty safe to say that neither of us enjoyed LOL from 2012.
Absolutely not. But as you know, we are open to other opinions. And that's why, before we started recording, Christian, I went and found another review to finish things off with. So we didn't find anything redeemable. But I have a review by an Amazon user by the name of Anna. Please stop judging before you've seen the movie. I really enjoyed this movie. I don't know what people are expecting when they see this movie. Are they expecting an Oscar-worthy movie? Because this is not one of those. It's a fun movie, great music, interesting plot, and great cast. I feel like half of these reviews are just people hating on this movie simply because they don't like Miley, or they're a parent who's all worried their kids are going to watch this. Sure, maybe kids under 14 shouldn't watch this, but it's not that serious. Just stop already. This movie is good. End of. And that's what it is. And that's five stars. So there you go. Somebody out there did like it.
And she possibly could have been of the Miley audience, you know, of that age group where, you know, anything that she did, they'd love. So, I don't know, maybe, you know, she was blinded by that, but really, she saw something in it that we didn't.
Yeah, pretty much. But at least I found a five-star review that didn't actually seem to be, like, someone being sarcastic. So there you go, that's pretty rare.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll let Anna entitle to her own opinions, and we'll keep ours.
Yep, and of course we want to hear your opinions on LOL if you have seen it. I certainly wouldn't recommend watching it after seeing it myself, but you never know. Somebody out there might have a different opinion, and we would love to hear your opinion on LOL. All the details on how to contact us will be at the end of the podcast. But we have something a bit more important to discuss now, Christian. I believe you may have a suggestion for our next redeeming features flick.
Yes, definitely. A film that I've been reading about for quite a while and never got around to seeing. Actually, no, I lie. I've probably seen about the first 5 or 10 minutes. And it's a film from 1987 called Ishtar, which was directed... starring... Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman. Now, typically, I don't know if it was more famous in America, but the 1987 flick was actually goes down in history as being one of the most expensive, well, one of the most big budget flops of all time. So, Trevor, I'm really interested in going back and seeing this because I have read a lot of people say, you know, you've got two camps, you know, people that say, don't think of the budget, it was actually a really good film, and other people say, oh, nothing can redeem this film. So, Trevor, I think you and I are due to explore this film and give it the Rufus Project treatment, I think, because I want to see, is this a movie that is worth seeing? Has it been unfairly kind of labelled with the term flop? You know, because a lot of times, you know, a film, you know, might not be a big box office success, but that's just because it didn't make $100 million. You know, it might have still made some sort of profit. So I'm interested to look at something and see whether it stands up on its own as actually a good or a bad film. So Ishtar from 1987, I'm really keen to check that one out.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm game for just about anything.
And I don't think anything's quite as bad as some of the movies we've been watching recently. So I think we're quite well conditioned at the moment. So
yeah, we haven't had a good run this year so far, have we?
I know, we seem to be getting deeper and deeper, but hey, you know, there's some movies out there that need to be redeemed, but we don't seem to be doing a very good job of doing it.
Well,
so let's hope Ishtar, you know, is a step up, but we shall see.
We shall. I know. I think after LOL, I would like to see a movie I can actually enjoy.
Yes.
Okay.
Always a pleasure, Trevor, and I look forward to speaking next time about Ishtar and hearing if anyone has seen or is going to see LOL and let us know your thoughts because, you know, we've shared ours.
Mm-hmm. And then some. Excellent. Well, hey, thank you so much, Christian.
No worries. Thanks so much, Trevor. We'll speak next time. Trois sucres sur le dos, dis-moi mon ange, tu courtises à 100 lieues des surprises de nos nuits, sur les pas, sous les toits.
Okay, the events continue for April 2015, and we're really excited to be able to kick things off with a Dream Plays fundraiser with a screening of El Topo on the 16th of April. Now, a Dream Play is appearing as part of Anywhere Theatre Festival in May, and as a fundraiser to send the cast to the festival and be able to put on a fantastic show. We're running a fundraiser which includes entry into the movie followed by live extracts from the show A Dream Play. El Topo screens at 6 p.m. on Thursday the 16th of April at New Globe Theatre, and tickets are $15 per person, and please note that all money raised will be donated straight to A Dream Play's production. If 90s more your sort of thing, on Saturday the 18th of April we've got the 90s video clip party at the New Globe Theatre. 220 Brunswick Street, Fortitude Valley. From 8:30 until midnight, over 3 hours of your favourite 90s music videos on the big screen. Dance the night away with drinks, friends, and 10 years of classic hits. Tickets are only $5 per person for this, and it kicks off at 8:30 on the 18th of April. We've got some great cult classics coming up, and excited to be able to do the Blu-ray release launch of Reanimator with Umbrella Entertainment. Now, this is happening on Wednesday, the 22nd of April, and Reanimator is a controversial, infamous cult classic, which will be screened completely uncut and uncensored on the big screen on the 22nd. Tickets are available at the door for $10 for that one, and that screens at 6:30 p.m. If you'd prefer to go back into the 60s, why not check out the motorbike classic Easy Rider, starring Peter Fonda, Jack Nicholson, and Dennis Hopper. Screening Friday the 24th of April at 6:30 p.m. at New Globe Theatre. Hey, why not stick around for after the show when they do their Jimi Hendrix vs. Doors live tribute show. This Old Chestnut is back, Labyrinth, starring Jennifer Connelly and David Bowie. Screening Wednesday the 29th of April at 6:30 p.m. Tickets are $10 at the door, and I definitely recommend pre-booking for this as it's quite a popular movie, and who knows if tickets will still be available. There's many more great events coming up, but check out www.christianfletcher.com for more information. I look forward to seeing you at an upcoming event very soon.
And now it's competition time. Thanks to Christian's wondrous generosity, we are giving away a double pass to that screening of Reanimator at New Globe Theatre on April 22nd. Now, as Christian just said, this is to celebrate the launch of the new Blu-ray version of this in full HD and completely uncut. It's gruesome, it's gory, it is glorious. So if you would like to win a double pass to this very special event, simply leave the comment Lovecraft in the comments on any of our many, many contact places. I'll be going through all those in just a moment when I wrap up this podcast. Definitely get your entries in. This is one you're not going to want to miss. Good luck. Thank you so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you have enjoyed listening to the last 1 year and 1 month of this podcast as much as we have enjoyed putting them all together. Now, if you would like to leave any feedback, any comments, any requests, any suggestion, or if you want to enter that fantastic Reanimator contest, could not be easier. Simply find The Rufus Project on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube, on Newstream. Head to therufusproject.podomatic.com or even hit up iTunes and leave us a review there. If you'd prefer to be a little more private in your conversation with us, you can also send us an email to rufusreviews@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you and definitely would love to give you guys free tickets. We're also always on the lookout for people who we can talk to in our local wildlife section. And on the internet, we are all local. We don't care where you are in the world. And if you have been listening from the start, let me just say that the interview we had with the guys behind the Super Mario Brothers comic strip, I was up at 2 o'clock in the morning in Australia to get that done. See, I am prepared to do that, to talk to anybody out there. So again, just get in touch with us. All those previous methods of contact are perfectly legitimate to do that. Want to have a bit more fun with what we've got to offer? We have a Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. We still only got the one design, but I promise there is another one on the way as soon as I can work out how to do it. It's going to be a beauty, and I think really fits in well with the sensibilities of The Rufus Project. You can also check out the stuff that we like listening to by heading to Bandcamp and searching for Rufus Project on the fan pages. And finally, the moral of this very special podcast is, if you can keep a relatively obscure podcast going for over a year, you've got to be doing something right. That's a pretty big confidence boost. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Look, I know we discussed rather extensively the current anti-piracy malarkey going on here in Australia, but I thought I'd just take a moment to mention what I think is probably the most effective anti-piracy malarkey going on in Australia right now. Well, not so much malarkey. I'm quite impressed that the Australian version of Netflix has launched with so many of its series intact and viewable in Australia. True, the full library is nowhere near what's overseas, but that's fairly easily bypassed, let's be honest. What is most impressive is that the upcoming Marvel Netflix series Daredevil is being released in Australia at the same time as the rest of the world. Netflix, I salute you. You have reduced the piracy level of this particular series by a phenomenal amount by making this very sensible, very obvious choice by of having the series that people want to watch available for people to watch. Congratulations, well done, big thumbs up. And by the way, if you don't have Netflix, sign up for the trial period and you'll be able to watch the whole series of Daredevil for free. And then stay with Netflix and set up an unblocking server so you can access the worldwide catalogue. It's so cool. Bye.